Welcome to Covenant Presbyterian Church in West Des Moines, Iowa. This educational offering is part of our mission to bless our neighbors to the glory of God. We hope it blesses you.
Good morning. So, I'm glad that I was able to put the fear into you with starting the video right at 9 o'clock last week. That was good, so now you're all here, with the exception of those of you who aren't, but some of you are excused. We are doing issues for faithful voters this month, looking at some of the issues that are just kind of present with the world in which we seek to be faithful to God and to live out that faithfulness as citizens of the United States. So my intention is always to sort of give us ways to think about the issues that are important in our world without necessarily saying this is the only way you can solve this issue, because obviously these are complicated things, and I have 19-minute videos to show you on them. So today we're going to talk about food security, and I have to admit, I can't remember for sure if anybody specifically requested that issue, but this is World Food Day week. Tuesday or Wednesday is the official day. So since all of that happens right here in Des Moines, I figured we should talk a little bit about food security. There is further watching that was in your Covenant Corner email on Tuesday, and a really interesting video looking at global hunger, food security as a global security issue. Ellen Gustafson took a map of places in the world that are food insecure and places in the world where violence is higher than in other parts of the world, and the maps fit right on top of each other. And of course, she acknowledges sort of the causality goes both directions on that, but it does flow from food insecurity into other kinds of violence in the world. She also spent some time then looking at the food system. She pointed out that hunger on a global scale and obesity on a systemic scale actually go hand in hand, that they're both connected to the food system that largely the United States has exported to the rest of the world, where producing calories is the primary goal of agriculture as compared to producing nutrition. So she's looking for sort of systemic change in the way globally we produce food. Today's video, here's from Josette Sheeran, who in 2011, when she spoke to us, was the head of the United Nations World Food Program. And she's going to talk to us about why, in a world with enough food for everybody, people still go hungry, still die of starvation, still use food as a weapon of war. So she's going to bring that question to us today. Why, in a world with so much food, are people hungry?
Well, after many years working in trade and economics, 4 years ago, I found myself working on the front lines of human vulnerability. And I found myself in the places where people are fighting every day to survive and can't even obtain a meal. This red cup comes from Rwanda, from a child named Fabian, and I carry this around as a symbol, really, of the challenge and also the hope. Because one cup of food a day changes Fabian's life completely. But what I'd like to talk about today is the fact that this morning, about 1 billion people on Earth, or 1 out of every 7, woke up and didn't even know how to fill this cup. 1 out of every 7 people. First, I'll ask you, why should you care? Why should we care? For most people, if they think about hunger, they don't have to go far back in their own family history, maybe in their own lives or their parents' lives or their grandparents' lives, to remember an experience of hunger. I rarely find an audience where people can go back very far without that experience. Some are driven by compassion, feel it's perhaps one of the fundamental acts of humanity, as Gandhi said, to a hungry man, a piece of bread is the face of God. Others worry about peace and security, stability in the world. We saw the food riots in 2008 after what I called the silent tsunami of hunger swept the globe when food prices doubled overnight. The destabilizing effects of hunger are known throughout human history. One of the most fundamental acts of civilization is to ensure people can get enough food. Others think about Malthusian nightmares. Will we be able to feed a population that will be 9 billion in just a few decades? This is not a negotiable thing, hunger. People have to eat. There's going to be a lot of people. This is jobs and opportunity all the way up and down the value chain. But I actually came to this issue in a different way. It's a picture of me and my 3 children. In 1987, I was a new mother with my first child and was holding her and feeding her when an image very similar to this came on the television. And this was yet another famine in Ethiopia. One 2 years earlier had killed more than 1 million people. But it never struck me as it did that moment, because on that image was a woman trying to nurse her baby, and she had no milk to nurse. And the baby's cry really penetrated me as a mother. And I thought, there's nothing more haunting than the cry of a child that cannot be returned with food, the most fundamental expectation of every human being. And it was at that moment that I just was filled with the challenge and the outrage that actually we know how to fix this problem. This isn't one of those rare diseases that we don't have a solution for. We know how to fix hunger. 100 years ago, we didn't. We actually have the technologies and systems. And I was just struck that this is out of place at our time in history. These images are out of place. Well, guess what? This is last week in northern Kenya. Yet again, the face of starvation at large scale with more than 9 million people wondering if they can make it to the next day. In fact, what we know now is that every 10 seconds, we lose a child to hunger. This is more than HIV, AIDS, malaria, and tuberculosis combined. And we know that the issue is not just production of food. And one of my mentors in life is Norman Borlaug, my hero. But today I'm going to talk about access to food, because actually, this year and last year and during the 2008 food crisis, there was enough food on Earth for everyone to have 2,700 kilocalories. So why is it that we have 1 billion people who can't find food? And I also want to talk about what I call our new burden of knowledge. In 2008, Lancet compiled all the research and put forward the compelling evidence that if a child in its first 1,000 days from conception to 2 years old does not have adequate nutrition, the damage is irreversible. Their brains and bodies will be stunted. And here you see a brain scan of 2 children, one who had adequate nutrition, another neglected, and who was deeply malnourished. And we can see brain volumes up to 40% less in these children. And in this slide, you see the neurons and the synapses in the brain don't form. And what we know now is this has a huge impact on economies, which I'll talk about later, but also the earning potential of these children is cut in half in their lifetime due to the stunting that happens in early years. So this burden of knowledge drives me, because actually we know how to fix it very simply. And yet, in many places, a third of the children, by the time they're three, already are facing a life of hardship due to this. I'd like to talk about some of the things I've seen on the front lines of hunger, some of the things I've learned, and bringing my economic and trade knowledge and my experience in the private sector, I'd like to talk about where the gap of knowledge is. Well, first I'd like to talk about the oldest nutritional method on earth, breastfeeding. You may be surprised to know that a child could be saved every 22 seconds if there was breastfeeding the first 6 months of life. But in Niger, for example, less than 7% of the children are breastfed for the first 6 months of life exclusively. In Mauritania, less than 3%. This is something that can be transformed with knowledge. This message, this word can come out that this is not an old-fashioned way of doing business, it's a brilliant way of saving your child's life. And so today we focus on not just passing out food, but making sure the mothers have enough enrichment and teaching them about breastfeeding. The second thing I'd like to talk about, if you were living in a remote village somewhere and your child was limp, and you were in a drought, or you were in floods, or you were in a situation where there wasn't adequate diversity of diet, what would you do? Do you think you could go to the store and get a choice of power bars like we can and pick the right one to match? Well, I find parents out on the front lines very aware their children are going down for the count. And I go to those shops, if there are any, or out to the fields to see what they can get, and they cannot obtain the nutrition. Even if they know what they need to do, it's not available. And I'm very excited about this, because one thing we're working on is transforming the technologies that are very available in the food industry to be available for traditional crops. And this is made with chickpeas, dried milk, and a host of vitamins matched to exactly what the brain needs. It costs 17 cents for us to produce this as what I call food for humanity. We did this with food technologists in India and Pakistan, really about three of them. But this is transforming 99% of the kids who get this, one package, 17 cents a day, their malnutrition is overcome. So I am convinced that if we can unlock the technologies that are commonplace in the richer world to be able to transform foods, and this is climate proof. It doesn't need to be refrigerated, it doesn't need water, which is often lacking. And these types of technologies, I see, have the potential to transform the face of hunger and nutrition, malnutrition, out on the front lines. The next thing I want to talk about is school feeding. 80% of the people of the world have no food safety net. When disaster strikes, the economy gets blown, people lose a job, floods, war, conflict, bad governance, all of those things, there is nothing to fall back on. And usually the institutions, churches, temples, other things do not have the resources to provide a safety net. What we have found working with the World Bank is that the poor man's safety net, the best investment is school feeding. And if you fill the cup with local agriculture from small farmers, you have a transformative effect. Many kids in the world can't go to school because they have to go beg and find a meal. But when that food is there, it's transformative. It costs less than 25 cents a day to change a kid's life. But what is most amazing is the effect on girls. In countries where girls don't go to school, and you offer a meal to girls in school, we see enrollment rates about 50% girls and boys. We see a transformation in attendance by girls, and there was no argument, because it's incentive. Families need the help. And we find that if we keep girls in school later, they'll stay in school till they're 16 and won't get married if there's food in school, or if they get an extra ration of food at the end of the week, costs about 50 cents, will keep a girl in school and they'll give birth to a healthier child because the malnutrition is sent generation to generation. We know that there's boom and bust cycles of hunger. We know this. Right now in the Horn of Africa, we've been through this before. So is this a hopeless cause? Absolutely not. I'd like to talk about what I call our warehouses for hope. Cameroon, Northern Cameroon, boom and bust cycles of hunger every year for decades. Food aid coming in every year when people are starving during the lean seasons. Well, 2 years ago, we decided let's transform the model of fighting hunger. And instead of giving out the food aid, we put it into food banks. And we said, listen, during the lean season, take the food out. You manage, the village manage these warehouses, and during harvest, put it back with interest, food interest. So add in 5%, 10% more food. For the past 2 years, 500 of these villages where these are have not needed any food aid. They're self-sufficient, and the food banks are growing, and they're starting school feeding programs for their children by the people of the village. But they've never had the ability to build even the basic infrastructure or the resources. I love this idea that came from the village level, three keys to unlock that warehouse. Food is gold there. And simple ideas can transform the face, not of small areas, of big areas of the world. I'd like to talk about what I call digital food. Technology is transforming the face of food vulnerability. In places where you see classic famine, Amartya Sen won his Nobel Prize for saying, guess what? Famines happen in the presence of food because people have no ability to buy it. We certainly saw that in 2008. We're seeing that now in the Horn of Africa, where food prices are up 240% in some areas over last year. Food can be there, people can't buy it. Well, this picture, I was in Hebron in a small shop, the shop, where instead of bringing in food, we provide digital food, a card, says Bon Appetit in Arabic, and the women can go in and swipe and get 9 food items. They have to be nutritious, and they have to be locally produced. And what's happened in the past year alone is the dairy industry, where this card is used for milk and yogurt and eggs, hummus, the dairy industry has gone up 30%. The shopkeepers are hiring more people. It is a win-win-win situation that starts the food economy moving. We now deliver food in over 30 countries over cell phones, transforming even the presence of refugees in countries and other ways. Perhaps most exciting to me is an idea that Bill Gates, Howard Buffett, and others have supported boldly, which is to ask the question, what if, instead of looking at the hungry as victims, and most of them are small farmers who cannot raise enough food or sell food to even support their own families, what if we view them as the solution, as the value chain to fight hunger? What if, from the women in Africa who cannot sell any food, there's no roads, there's no warehouses, there's not even a tarp to pick the food up with, what if we give the enabling environment for them to provide the food to feed the hungry children elsewhere? And Purchasing for Progress today is in 21 countries. And guess what? In virtually every case, when poor farmers are given a guaranteed market, if you say, we will buy 300 metric tons of this, we'll pick it up, we'll make sure it's stored properly, their yields have gone up 2, 3, 4-fold, and they figure it out. Because it's the first guaranteed opportunity they've had in their life, and we're seeing people transform their lives. Today, food aid, our food aid, huge engine, 80% of it is bought in the developing world. Total transformation that can actually transform the very lives that need the food. Now, you'd ask, can this be done at scale? These are great ideas, village-level ideas. Well, I'd like to talk about Brazil, because I've taken a journey to Brazil over the past couple of years when I read that Brazil was defeating hunger faster than any nation on earth right now. And what I found is rather than investing their money in food subsidies and other things, they invested in a school feeding program. And they require that a third of that food come from the smallest farmers who would have no opportunity. And they're doing this at huge scale after President Lula declared his goal of ensuring everyone have 3 meals a day. And this zero hunger program costs 0.5% of GDP and has lifted many millions of people out of hunger and poverty. It is transforming the face of hunger in Brazil. And it's at scale, and it's creating opportunities. I've gone out there, I've met with the small farmers who have built their livelihoods on the opportunity and platform provided by this. Now, if we look at the economic imperative here, this isn't just about compassion. The fact is, studies show that the cost of malnutrition and hunger, the cost to society, the burden it has to bear, is on average 6%, and in some countries up to 11% of GDP a year. And if you look at the 36 countries with the highest burden of malnutrition, that's $260 billion lost from a productive economy every year. Well, the World Bank estimates it would take about $10 billion, 10.3, to address malnutrition in those countries. You look at the cost-benefit analysis, and my dream is to take this issue not just from the compassion argument, but to the finance ministers of the world and say we cannot afford to not invest in the access to adequate, affordable nutrition for all of humanity. The amazing thing, as I found, is nothing can change on big scale without the determination of a leader. When a leader says, not under my watch, everything begins to change. And the world can come in with enabling environments and opportunities to do this. And the fact that France has put food at the center of the G20 is really important. Because food is one issue that cannot be solved person by person, nation by nation. We have to stand together. And we're seeing nations in Africa. WFP has been able to leave 30 nations, because they have transformed the face of hunger in their nations. What I would like to offer here is a challenge. I believe we're living at a time in human history where it's just simply unacceptable that children wake up and don't know where to find a cup of food. Not only that, transforming hunger is an opportunity, but I think we have to change our mindsets. I am so honored to be here with some of the world's top innovators and thinkers, and I would like you to join with all of humanity to draw a line in the sand and say no more. No more, we can accept this. And we want to tell our grandchildren that there was a terrible time in history where up to a third of the children had brains and bodies that were stunted, but that exists no more. Thank you.
Speaking in 2011, Sharon said, about 1 in 7 people in the world woke up this morning food insecure, not knowing where they would obtain the food that they needed that day. And she said, the problem is not quantity of food. She was speaking at a time when 3 years running we had globally produced enough food for everyone in the world to have 2,700 calories, which is more than is needed. But access is the problem. And she points out that hunger in early childhood permanently affects neural development. Neural development during that time is permanently stunted. So then she talks about the technologies and systems that would be needed to address hunger on a global scale, talking about education and specifically talking about knowledge of breastfeeding. Not that knowledge of the existence of breastfeeding is news to anyone, but there's a cultural formation piece that needs to happen around breastfeeding, particularly in the developing world. Where that's part of the global food system. She talked about those emergency food packets that can provide necessary nutrition at 17 cents a day. She talked about school meals and especially the value of school meals for girls, both getting girls into school and keeping girls in school, and the way that especially feeding girls breaks that generational cycle of malnutrition. Food banking, which I just thought was brilliant, that at a community level, you can store food, withdraw food when you need it, and then pay it back later with interest so that the food bank, the community's store of food, continues to grow. Purchasing support for local nutritious food.
This food banking, the idea came across my mind, is our village in San Ysidro able to do something like this?
That is a great question. Would the canton of San Ysidro be able to develop a food bank?
Or maybe they don't have enough food to...
I don't know how the... I don't have updates on the sort of the current growing year. The crops completely failed last year because the rains didn't come. So the tropical climate is based on a dry season and a wet season. And the rainy season was to begin, it typically begins in about mid-May, and then it rains more or less nonstop through about November or so, and it didn't, which happens from time to time, but it's happening more and more often, that the rains just didn't come. So there's work to be done to prime the pump, but if, you know, get the community food stable, and then you get a good year and you can bank some of that food, I don't know to what extent that may even already be happening. I don't know the, it's not a question I've had a chance to ask, but I think it would be a great one to ask. I would assume that there are additional sort of questions of stability that have to be answered, and I don't know how they would be resolved specifically in the context of San Ysidro. But you know, you look at those you know, three people with three keys. I mean, it looks like they're launching a nuclear weapon, right? I mean, we used to have the two keys and you had to turn them at the same place. That we still do, right? But I suppose. But that was in the movie, right?
Right.
Tom Clancy always had that scene. So the idea that you have to have three people from the community all together to open that door at the same time, you know, that's a level of community oversight. You can also see how that, you know, you can see the problem that's an answer to, right? The exploitation of that food bank by bad faith actors in that community. So you need a certain level of stability in the community that, again, is the food security and security against violence, these play into each other. So you need a stable community. So that's where, you know, all of that, I don't know what that ends up looking like specifically in, whether in San Ysidro or in the Berlin in general. It is also possible to get food into there. But you're right, I mean, we're talking about subsistence farmers who, you know, the more they could build the stock of what it is they are able to produce, the better.
I mean, I don't want to infer at all that the farmers that are there aren't trying their best.
No, I didn't get that meaning from you. The farmers are doing their utmost to try to get crops out of soil that's just unimaginably poor.
And they only have like an acre and a half, isn't it, to farm?
Right, yeah. Yeah, tiny little spaces to farm.
45 degree angle hills.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And can I ask, what are the crops that they can grow there?
Beans.
Corn and beans.
Corn and beans.
Yeah.
Beans grow up on the corn stalks.
Really?
Yeah.
Yeah. And so, that would be a really interesting question, and a question of whether that's the right approach in a depending on sort of the infrastructure that's there in El Salvador versus the infrastructure that that was in the country where that photo was taken. On the other hand, there's no one approach. That's where I caught myself. There's no one approach that's going to do all of this. So, yeah.
We're still coming back to teach the man to fish, opposed to
eating
the fish.
Yeah. So as I was listening, and this is the third or fourth time I've watched this talk, but I quickly jotted down the last spring when we were looking at. I think it was last spring, when we were looking at the different strategies for addressing income inequality, which that book was looking at income inequality in our community, but the community has 7+ billion people in it, right? Mm-hmm. So we have those four strategies: charity, which is give a man a fish, right? Self-help, which is teach a man to fish. Cultural formation, which is change the values such that fishing is a thing that is done, and advocacy and governmental action, figure out a way that the man can even be allowed to fish, right? And that these are, you'll remember from our conversations about addressing income inequality, we need all four of those because they all do different things. They're all parts of an approach to the same problem. Teaching a man to fish, making sure that there's infrastructure there for the storage of the crops, in addition to these are skilled farmers. I sure couldn't farm there. These are skilled farmers in a terrain where essentially none of this would be planted by an Iowan farmer, because the slopes are all too steep for Iowan farmers, because we've got less slopey land right next door to it. So so this is all territory where the way that we even think about farming in Iowa doesn't quite apply. But there is, what would it look like to have an infrastructure where this could happen? And then What are some other structures that also make this possible? So, the purchasing support for nutritious local food. So the essentially what food card? It's a EBT card is what we call them here, right? The electronic card that gets you access to your SNAP benefits, that we still call them food stamps, just like we still call it a Xerox machine. But an electronic card that will allow you to purchase locally grown food, and guaranteed purchases from small farmers. So I loved that she said 80% of the World Food Program aid is purchased in the developing world. So this is no longer primarily, American farmers sending our surplus overseas as aid. It is aid being purchased in the developing countries where it's needed.
I don't know how the digital food card works. I don't know if how much does it cost?
Right.
And, the owner of the store, how does
that work?
Yeah, how does all that work?
That's a great question. Is that Lebanon, Syria? Can't remember where that photo was. So in the World Food Program system, I don't know for sure. In the in the Iowa SNAP system, it is effectively the same as the way that your credit card works. So EBT, electronic benefits transfer, essentially the card is swiped for the cost of the food, the funds to pay for that food are electronically transferred to the merchant. I'm sure they have to sign up for the program and so forth. The Iowa Farm Bureau has for many years supported farmers markets being places where SNAP benefits can be used through that same electronic benefits transfer card.
I get the idea.
Yeah.
In Brazil, she's talking about the one meal a day. That's done through the corporations. Each corporation is required to make sure that they have a benefit that the employee has is they get a card. And they, when they go out at lunch, they take a credit card, the food card, and they go into any deli or whatever else and they have to buy the food. Now, most of the produce that's coming into Brazil is probably grown locally. So I don't know if it's small farmers, but it's agriculture within Brazil. Brazil's bright spot is their agriculture at this point in time.
Right, and
so it's worse through the companies.
Okay,
it's not quite as governmentally controlled. The company, the government says you will give the employee the benefit of one meal a day. We want to make sure every person gets paid or has food. So
if you were to take sort of our four strategies, our four types of strategies, and categorize that one, bearing in mind that Brazil since a couple of years ago is a different beast than Brazil at the time she was speaking.
And it's been 9 years since I've been in Brazil.
Right. So Brazil under Lula, which Sheeran was talking about, is a different place from Brazil under Bolsonaro. But Kent, if we were talking about charity, self-help, cultural formation, or advocacy and governmental action, how would you categorize the policy in Brazil where a corporation has to provide a square meal a day electronically to their employees?
To me, that was governmental. It was a requirement.
Mm-hmm. What? I didn't hear.
It was governmental in my mind. The government required certain things as a corporation to do. And one of the employee benefits is to get a meal a day. So the government required that
right.
as part of the package.
Right. And so the funding for that comes from the corporation.
Right.
The requirement comes from the government, and the money flows to
the individual and
the local
food
markets.
The local markets.
And you're right, to the individual in the sense that they get the nutrition.
Yep.
Farmers get the money.
And even now, the agriculture. But there's a two-edged sword to every problem.
Right, yeah. So agriculture in Brazil is also sort of agricultural expansion in Brazil, particularly right now, is also awful for the climate because expansion of agriculture in Brazil has tended to go into the Amazon, which is being cut down and burned, to make room for largely what?
A lot of sugar cane and such.
Sugar cane, soybeans.
Soybeans, yep.
Cattle.
Yeah. Because as the food chain
For the export market, right? So the export market complicates the sort of the local food question and the environmental question here. Looking now, I mean, you were last in Brazil shortly before this talk was given.
Right.
We are able also now to look back and say, oh, this is more complicated. Everything's more complicated, right? Pam?
Well, I was just thinking, you know, even in this country we've got SNAP and food pantries and stuff. People are still hungry.
Right.
There's still not enough, so we don't have it figured out.
Right, yeah.
How to get food to people.
Right. Yeah, so SNAP doesn't get everyone fed. SNAP is the the food assistance, the basically the purchasing support electronic food program.
In the food pantry, there's a limit, and I
right.
When I worked some on Saturdays back when Crossley had the program, mm-hmm. I'm thinking this isn't enough food to last a week. You know, we can only go certain. I don't remember how many times a month.
Right. Yeah. So food pantries don't solve the whole problem. SNAP doesn't solve the whole problem.
And then even if you've got programs to feed your kids in school, and the backpack rough runs, and
mm-hmm. Right.
One of the other things that plays into this is as the China, for example, they have a middle class that has grown, and now they're requiring more protein, i.e. more beef, more meat, mm-hmm. which requires corn, etc. to feed the cattle.
Right.
And from feeding the masses, that doesn't quite work out too well.
Yeah, and so there's a this is a cultural formation question and if you were to also check out the further watching from Ellen Gustafson, the question of the food system that we export, and she takes care to say that we don't just export food, we export a food system, a way of thinking about food. And part of what we export is American culture, where it's like not a meal in America unless something died for it, right? Right?
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
It's hard work. Actually, it's try eating out with a vegetarian sometimes. It is hard work, or a vegan. That's even more complicated, and it's expensive. So it's hard work to find a sort of culturally identifiable American entree that is not based on a piece of meat.
Well, it's hard to go to fast food with a vegetarian.
Yeah,
I got a granddaughter.
Yeah,
and she just is just she just doesn't want to think. Doesn't think we should kill animals, that sort of thing. But anyway, she's, trying to eat vegetables. Well, then she ends up eating a lot of pasta. Well, now that's not good.
Right.
Yeah.
But that's empty calories, you know,
right.
That's not the right thing. And I was going to add, a few years ago, and I don't remember where, I think it was Nestle that made a formula for, milk mm-hmm. formula. They were promoting that in Africa mm-hmm. instead of the women breastfeeding. They said, well, this is the way you should go.
Yeah.
This is what the modern woman
right.
does.
So there, that's and where
that
the cultural
was a bad,
thing happens,
that wasn't
right?
a good thing. You know?
So that cultural thing is, let's be honest, also an economic thing, right? Because Nestle can make money on formula. They can't make money on lentils that people in Africa grow and then eat, right?
Yeah.
So there is also an economic layer to that. Setting the economic layer aside, which I do advisedly, right? Like, don't forget that's there. But that's very comparable to the way that increasing standards of living in especially China, also India, also other parts of the sort of the leading edge of the developing world, places that were developing, that back when we used the word third world country, if you would have used the word third world country then about it, but you wouldn't use developing world about it now, those countries, they eat meat like Americans. And there's 1.5 billion people in China. Or more. I lose track. Numbers. There's a giant number of people in China. Also a giant number of people in India. For religious reasons, people in India tend to eat less meat than people in China. But that's changing too. Because meat is what? Tasty. And status, right? So culturally, meat is status. You know? You serve, you might eat beans yourself, but you serve meat to your guests, right? And then as you get to where you can treat yourself like company because you've got the money for it, then you serve meat to yourself. And that happened in the United States in some of y'all's lifetimes, right?
Yes.
And is happening right now to another few billion people, which is not, like, I want to be really clear, like, I don't think people in China should not get to eat meat, right? Setting aside, you know, ethical arguments for not killing animals, fine. But the idea that sort of American culture has been exported into countries that now can afford to eat like Americans, well, no wonder they are, right? So there's a cultural formation question that is actually, you know, it's meat versus breast milk, but it's the same cultural formation question, right? That is, yes, also layered in with an economic question. Not only about can people afford it, but also Nestle, you know, okay, Nestle doesn't make money from people eating beef, but, you know, Tyson makes money from a global meat market rather than only a national meat market. Whereas, you know, the profit in lentils really just is lower, right? And partly that's American farm bill stuff. So this is all super complicated. But where do we look to address sort of emergency short-term needs with charitable interventions like 17-cent food packets or combination things from Meals from the Heartland? Where do we, where and how can we have the kinds of relationships with communities in need where we can actually support local efforts to food bank, to increase productive capacity, to restore soil, to stabilize communities? How do we address the cultural issues that make for an unsustainable food system? Where do we need governmental work, and not only local or national governments, but intergovernmental work in order to address all of this? That's super complicated. Who wants the last word?
I have a question.
Yes.
When I was in D.C. this last time, there was a little market or snack shop or whatever attached to a World Food store. And anyhow, it was right across from the high school. And I mean, kids were just flocking to place right and left. Uh-huh. It's called Wawa. W-A-W-A, like that food packet. Does that have anything?
I don't know if those are connected. There's a convenience store chain in the Mid-Atlantic called Wawa.
Okay.
If it had like a goose or something as part of the logo, that was just a convenience store chain. I don't know that they're connected.
Okay, I was just curious.
But maybe it is. Maybe it's, you know, and maybe it's like a, you know, sort of like, you know, kind of like astronaut ice cream, like, you know, food that maybe you wouldn't be excited about except for its association. So maybe it is directly like, you know, hey, come, you know,
and then I wondered if, you know,
for $1.50 you buy a 17-cent packet of food and we send the other $1.23 off to save more. I don't know.
The one thing in her teeth that I really think about is where they were feeding the girls, and you know, you get them into school, they had the protein and they were also learning.
Yeah.
And I've read that if you can teach a woman to read, then there's a good chance her offspring will also read, and because she'll take care of the family in that manner. And because part of this is an ongoing problem in a sense of population problem, growth. And if you can educate the people, then they also understand how to deal with other related issues that go along with it. And that's the part that really I focused on in the film.
Right, so education being another, and particularly girls' education, tends to reduce population growth, it tends to improve nutrition, it tends to improve education of the subsequent generation. Educate girls.
And that,
it's all 400.
Well, it's just a multi.
It's a
shotgun. Yeah. You have to have a shotgun approach.
Yeah.
It's not going to be a rifle. There is no one problem.
Right.
And Syrian war was basically started by food famine, because the farmers 4 or 5 years prior to the Civil War were migrating into the cities because of crop failures. And with all these unemployed, they had nothing better to do, but and that just grew into the mess it was.
So we are going to set that there. Come back next week. We're going to talk about, I believe we're going to talk about health care. I don't know what we're going to say about it.
Thank you for listening. Learn more about our mission at wdmcovenant.org.